7. And of course, be sure to join this conversation, which is of course the Wednesday panel. We got a wonderful suggestion from one of our colleagues, Saskia Hickey, indicating that she would love to get a sense of how narratives play into the political discourse. It's been a very long time, I think, or at least I could ask many of you, when last you voted on the basis of policy. Which policy? How was it different from the opponent? Some people suggest that we vote on the basis of personality. I don't think so. It's not actually really proven. We've got people whose personalities are droog, but their narrative is so good, it makes sense for one to vote for them. And that's what we want to talk about today. Director of Project at the Center for Analytics and Behavioral Change at UCT's Graduate School of Business, Stuart Jones, joins us on one side of the panel. Good morning, Stuart. Welcome to Breakfast with Refilwe. How are you?
I'm very well and good morning.
Good morning. Solly Moeng is Brand Reputation Management Advisor and CEO at Don Valley. Hi, Solly. Welcome back to the show. How are you today?
Good morning, Refilwe, and to listeners. Hello. I'm good. Thank you.
Excellent stuff. All right. So we can take it from Jacob Zuma, George W. Bush, Boris Johnson. You know, I want to talk about some of the ladies. I mean, Hillary Clinton, you could have an amazing track record. Hillary Clinton often touted as the most qualified person to run for the U.S. presidency. And yes, she got the popular vote, but ultimately she did not win the presidency. And it's a constant reminder that, first of all, qualification, secondly, policy, and in many respects, I'm starting to find personality have got nothing to do with how voters vote. Why is narrative so important? I'll kick off with you, Solly, from a brand perspective, brand reputation perspective.
Well, you know, Refilwe, I think it's known that an average person has a very short attention span. And an average voter is not going to read the whole policy document before they decide whether they're going to vote for a candidate or not. They look at the superficial stuff. You know, so Malema is known to be fighting for the economic rights of poor black people, and that's what matters. They're not going to look into what else he's saying in his policy document so that they decide whether or not it balances out or that it helps them make an informed decision. And the same thing applies. Lucas Mangope was an awesome speaker. Apparently, Hitler was a very charismatic speaker. I've seen videos of him. Robert Mugabe, same thing. Zuma, people just love the way he dances and he mixes with people. They don't care about all the wrong things he's done. So, and that's a problem. So what's the narrative around the person? What's the one-liner, really, that defines what the person stands for? This is what people go for.
Stuart, from your perspective, as a recipient of that information that Solly is talking about and how it impacts my behavioral change, how much does it take in terms of reiterating that narrative message to get me over the line in the ballot box?
Well, for us, the reiteration, we study social media in particular, and the internet in general and social media in particular has forever changed the way that power is contested. You know, narratives are about storytelling. Narratives are about bringing, in the brand context, a brand to life. And a lot of that is done on social media, about telling a story. And I think to Solly's point, beyond the policy lies on one level, perhaps the personality, and on another level, the identity of the voter. And we saw that really strongly in the American election. And American politics has become particularly identity driven. You are Republican or you are Democrat, and there's an entire identity that lies behind that, and all sorts of kind of policy positions that are sucked into that identity as a result. What we see in South Africa is socially divisive narratives that politicians then attach themselves to. So particularly last year, we tracked a really, really hectic. I can't use the word hectic.
I remember this one, yes. Shocking xenophobia. Yeah.
Shocking xenophobia network, organized network, that was drumming up xenophobia. And then smaller political parties were attaching themselves to it. You know, so from a branding perspective, one talks about that as a positioning space. And then you tell a story off of that positioning, which was around xenophobia. So this stuff can be really, really complex, but also at its heart, it's quite simple. It is about a story. It is about a narrative. It's about connecting with voters in this context and persuading them to vote for you. And I agree. Often that's not so much about policy as it is about identity and it is about story.
I want to, before we go to the break, after the break, I want us to dig into the divisive side of things, because it seems as though narratives that don't necessarily have strong policy support are driven much more from the negative and fear-mongering, okay, when you speak about identity. But before we go there, I just want to challenge the one thing you were saying about personality, identity versus narrative. I feel as though, you know, the example you used with the American election, Donald Trump was widely accepted to be a horrible person. Horrible. Rude, brash, arrogant, thin-skinned. But the idea that here is this boy of New York who made himself multimillionaire, and some people say billionaire, but not so much, and was able to stick it to the swamp. You see, the arc is more important, I think, than the personality, surely.
I would agree with you there. And in retrospect, Bernie Sanders should have been put up as the Democratic candidate in that election,
right?
Because voters wanted change, the American version of a revolution, I suppose. They wanted real change. They were sick and tired of Washington and that kind of Washington consensus, if you like. And so I think, Trump dove into that zeitgeist. But at the same time, remember that at the heart of it, Trump was all about division and about othering. He took every opportunity he could to create an us and them scenario, and ultimately that won him the election.
All right. Stay woke, white capital, white monopoly capital. I want to bring Solly into that division after we go to traffic, and we'll continue this panel right here. Welcome back to the Wednesday panel. It's 8:20. I'm joined by Solly Moeng. He's brand reputation management advisor and CEO at Don Valley, and Stuart Jones, who's director of projects at the Center for Analytics and Behavioral Change at UCT's GSB. We were talking before the break about the divisiveness of narrative. And while we are having that discussion, WhatsApp came through saying, morning, I think I will vote for who I believe will deliver rather than what they promise in terms of policy. So that's got a personality trait to it, doesn't it, right? The idea that the person's accountable and will follow through. But what do we do, for example, in Cape Town's situation? Every one of our candidates for mayor is a fresh face. Dan Plato may not run. The DA did not give him the mandate to run on their behalf. We've got Jordan Hill Lewis. We've got Neil De Beer. We've got Brett Herron. We've got Grant Claassen and Christopher Claassen that we've met so far, and many others that will come out on September 7th. Solly, how does one get that voter's attention, for example, in light of this narrative building?
Well, I mean, each party, in the case of Cape Town, the DA has to spend a bit of a fortune on their mayoral candidate, their favorite one, the one they chose, and create a narrative around him. Because he's not known; he's generally unknown. To be honest, I didn't know much about him until he was announced by the DA, and I think many people don't. So we need to know, who is this guy beyond what the picture we see? What does he stand for? What is he promising? And he has to repeat that story over and over again, so that he's associated with something. And an expectation is created around him if he gets elected. So that's what they need to do. People don't read. I still think people do not read long policy documents. They want to know what this person says. And there are also contradictions. I mean, if you think Malema is for South Africa's borders to be open so that all the Africans who want to come here may come here. But most poor South Africans don't want that to happen. But they still like the Malema who's still apparently fighting for the economic freedom. So people don't interrogate things. They just want, what is the narrative around this person that really suits me? And I'll hang on to that narrative irrespective of what. The same thing applied to Trump. People don't care about many other things that he's doing that are contradictory, that were not good for America and for the world, but they liked the fact that he was him. Look at Zuma. And contrast him to Mbeki. Mbeki was a very presidential gentleman. You know, everything's been said about him, and he still is presidential when he stands up to speak. Whether one agrees with him or not, he has that temperament of a president, as it were. And Zuma didn't have it, but people were wanting a change at the time, so they went for Zuma, who dances, who can hug you, who's seemingly approachable. And then look at where it got us to, because they don't look at the detail of the person, of what the offering is.
Okay, so I think we accept that policy is not the thing. But let's talk a little bit about a number of those examples. The presidentialness of Thabo Mbeki, but at the end of the day, the narrative around HIV/AIDS hangs around his neck. You've got the, and then at the same time, you've got this, yes, very approachable, and he is a consultative man in Jacob Zuma, but the narrative, despite the narrative of state capture, rape, he's Teflon. How does that rationality or lack of rationality work with a voter mind?
An average voter is lazy. I think that we have to agree that an average voter is lazy. That's why politicians who are wrong always get away with stuff. Because they repeat what the voter wants to hear.
But Solly, sorry, a lazy voter in South Africa sitting in Murling right now knows that Thabo Mbeki has got bad news with respect to HIV/AIDS, but happened to have been his president before the World Cup, and at least, you know. But, and that same voter knows that they're starving at the moment after a Zuma presidency, and that corruption is a big deal, but he got two terms. I'm asking more about even the things that are right on the face of it, right in front of us. How are we so irrational? Is it the, yeah.
Look, there's also the mob mentality that goes with it, right? Who are your friends voting for? A lot of people will go with what their friends, their gang, their club, their boss, somebody they respect will go for. So they don't interrogate the detail. Again, it's about who is fashionable today. I mean, the stuff that you're mentioning about Mbeki was not fired because of the HIV, his narrative on HIV/AIDS. He was not fired because of his policies. All those things are post their presidents. Even Zuma, when he was president, a lot of people supported him. All right, it's after he left. Even now, people are still supporting him. Right. You know, they're not fired for those things. They don't leave office because they did badly in those things. They stay in office for the opposite, because they are popular, because they know how to appeal to the people who matter to them as voters.
Stuart, let's talk a bit about that from behavioral responses amongst voters. What Solly's highlighting here, maybe not so much about those who are fired, but in helping us get through the Cape Town mayoral election, about how we get them hired. What is this repeated message that we're supposed to hear, for example, from Jordan Hill Lewis, from Brett Heron, from all of these candidates? Because what I'm hearing from Solly is, yeah, the party exists, but the party is the policy. It's the guy.
I would push back on that a little bit, because, you know, I mean, I think South Africa, I don't know if South Africa is terribly different to other democracies, but we tend to vote for a party, you know, and within the party, a personality rises to the top. Now, Mbeki was ousted by his own party, by the ANC, and I agree with Solly, it wasn't particularly because of HIV/AIDS policy. It was more around his personality, how he was kind of centralizing power inside of the presidency, and how he played the internal politics of the ANC. Now, Zuma rose to power because he played the internal politics of the ANC particularly well. And I think globally, we've seen a rise of these populist politicians. Sometimes they tend to tap into what people are genuinely feeling. Zuma is ultimately a social conservative, and he tapped into that strain of the ANC on a kind of mass mobilization basis. But also within the party, he played the politics really well, and he has an engaging personality. Now, when it comes to the mayoral race for Cape Town, as an example, people are going to vote most likely for a party more than they're going to vote for a candidate. So I would guess that the DA will fall back on their same old, which is saying that they're the efficient party and so on. They've blotted their copybook, of course, a bit with that, because as soon as they got outside of Cape Town, that didn't apply as well. But they can fall back on that. And so I would expect, I actually can't remember his name, to be honest.
Jordan Hill Lewis.
Yes, exactly. Sorry. And yes, which I think is exactly the point.
I was about to say,
Yeah. I mean, the reality is, if he wins, he's going to win because he's from the DA. And, you know, Brett Heron, if he loses, is probably going to lose because he's with the good party and doesn't attract enough votes because of that. You know, that's the most likely occurrence. And then, of course, there's coalition politics that is now more and more coming into the space. And this is where it gets really, really difficult, because when you get to municipal elections, it's real bread and butter politics. And 1,000 votes here, 10,000 votes there can sway a municipality and can even sway a mayorship. Particularly in smaller municipalities, and that's where divisive messaging is most effectively for these politicians. You stand on a xenophobic platform because the ANC won't, the EFF won't, but a smaller party will. You get enough votes just to be the kingmaker, or the couple of percentage points that tips a coalition over that 50% mark, and suddenly you've got real power. And that's the real danger that we're facing, I think, as we go into the municipal elections, either later this year or early next.
Well, that's pretty much how the EFF did it, right? And I guess that's how we are possibly going to see, say, the likes of Cape Exit, who have a very strong perspective that is divisive and people can align with firmly, which is, I suppose, more powerful than a positive message of, I hope we end crime. There's something that the source document for this idea, Tom Ewing wrote this great piece on narratives and politics. One of the points that he makes, he says, or to put it simply, I quote, fame, feeling, and fluency. If the brand comes easily to mind, fame feels good, feeling, and is quickly recognized, fluency. So fluency and fame not working so well for Jordan. And fluency, I think, works well for Brett, for example, in terms of being quickly recognized and fame. But I don't know if it goes with a good feeling, because people have these memories of him in the city. That's what we hear from our listeners. And then I suppose the other three gentlemen that I mentioned, yeah, I guess they fail on fluency in general because nobody really knows them. How would you, I suppose feeling is what gets picked up in those divisive moments. Why are negative feelings so much stronger to rally?
Well, when people are angry, I mean, and you say to them, I'm going to help you deal with the source of your anger, it can be quite appealing. When someone is poor and you say, I'm going to help with that, and that's globally, you know, unemployment is a key driver in politics and in electoral politics around the world. We're going to lower unemployment figures. We're going to make you feel better. We're going to get rid of these foreigners who are here. And it's not unique to South Africa. I lived in France, and most of the people who we see cleaning the streets or guiding cars in South Africa, at the time, they were from Portugal. And there was a strong sentiment against Portuguese who came and did all the work that the French anyway didn't want to do. So, but then you have a politician who say, well, you know, those jobs could be occupied by your children. You could be doing those jobs. And those negative sentiments of scapegoating other people. And then you have a politician who says, you know, I'm your savior. I'm going to deal with that on your behalf. It easily catches fire.
Stuart, your thoughts? Anti-wokeism, white monopoly capital, which I don't know if that works much in a municipal conversation, but certainly anti-social justice. We're seeing people want to protect their spaces, wealthy spaces in particular, NIMBY politics. And I'm trying to think what other sort of negative sentiments are being thrown around. Well, how do you think those will play out?
Well, the reality is that, you know, if people are afraid and people are desperate and people are poor and people are hungry and people are angry, it's very easy to manipulate. Those are real emotions and real conditions that people are feeling now, particularly after lockdown and with unemployment rate as high as it is, etc. We live in such a demonstrably unequal society. It's incredibly easy to push those cracks open and create that fear and that division. You know, there are stats on social media which suggest that negative messaging spreads six times as fast as positive messaging. So it's exacerbated massively by social media, and the algorithms of these social media platforms actually almost deliberately push negative messaging. So it creates incredible momentum and is effective. You know, there's not. It's hard to say much more than that. It's something that we need to try and push back against, I think, with positive messaging. But the reality is that it's dominating politics. And as Sorry says, not just in South Africa, this is a global phenomenon.
Yeah, I wonder if it's a scarcity issue. Post global financial crisis, everybody's a little poorer, less to share, less generous. Gents, we're completely out of time. I'm so sorry. Solly Mwing, brand reputation management advisor and CEO at Don Valley. So grateful for your insights. Stuart Jones, director of project at the Center for Analytics and Behavioral Change at UCT's GSB. Such a pleasure getting your thoughts, gents. Have a wonderful morning.